Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Karen Celestan, who's the creator, along with Eric Waters, of Freedom's Dance, social aid and pleasure clubs in New Orleans. A joyful, beautiful new book celebrates one of the most important aspects of New Orleans culture. It's Freedom's Dance, Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs in New Orleans, with photographs by Eric Waters and narrative by Karen Celestan. Karen's also known for her book with Harold Batiste Jr., Unfinished Blues, Memories of a New Orleans Music Man. We're speaking to her today from Houston, where she teaches at Texas Southern University. Karen, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here and to be on the airwaves of WWNO and my alma mater, the University of New Orleans and the Mighty Privateers.
Amen for that. Well, congratulations on this beautiful book. Yes. It's such a big book and it's such a big subject. And the book has a lot of moving parts. You have great photographs. I'm so sorry Eric Waters can't be with us today. And so many essays by leading scholars and wonderful interviews with participants in Second Lines. So tell us how you went about tackling this big topic.
Oh, yeah. It wound up, we had to break it into pieces, parts, as you well imagine. And first we had to have, Eric and I had a vision. And then we had to figure out how to translate that vision to the page, which is flat, for a very kinetic type of culture that moves around quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So we sort of, what we did first was winnow photographs down. Looked at hundreds and thousands of images, if you could imagine, over that 15-year period that we worked on the book. And some things got thrown out, and some things got replaced, and, you know, we argued. It was just a thing. But the underlying effort was to try to capture as much of the culture as we possibly could via photograph and then sort of shape the narrative around it.
Now, you go all the way back to the beginnings of Second Line culture and its African roots. Joyce Jackson talks about that in her essay. So describe for us those roots.
Well, I'll try to do it in short order. It's a long-form process. But if you could imagine, if people could go to the west coast of Africa, the Bight of Benin, and all of those countries that are on that coast of Africa that faces the ocean, those were the people who, most of the people were captured in the slave trade, and the transatlantic slave trade, to be more specific. And those are the people that wound up in New Orleans, because New Orleans is and was a port city. So those are a lot of the tribes that were represented in the city, and then wound up in Congo Square because Sundays was the free day, quote-unquote, for slaves to gather, meet one another, and sell their wares right there, right next to what used to be Municipal Auditorium and next to Armstrong Park.
And underneath all this, underneath all the stuff that's grown up about Second Line culture, is the funeral Second Line.
Yeah,
and I think that is so important for us to remember that grief and community were the underlying emotions behind it. And one of the things I found so incredibly moving in this book was Eric Waters' interview with Lois Andrews. I found that so moving.
Yes, yes. She is Trombone Shorty, also known as Troy, and James Andrews' mother. And Eric was able to capture her doing something that is very Afro-Caribbean, which is dancing on the coffin of your beloved, which people can't even fathom. And it's an exceedingly difficult thing to do because a coffin is very slick.
Right.
But she has incredible balance and grace, and she's able to maneuver herself up there and stay upright and pay tribute. Because in African tradition, the passing from this life is you're grieving the loss and that you won't see that person anymore. But it's also an expression of joy that this person has been released back to God and the ancestors. So what you see in the midst of her grief is that, okay, my son has passed away and I'm going to miss him so, but God has taken him and he's with our family's ancestors. So that's a point of joy. So it's a mixture mm-hmm. of grief and joy that you see in those photographs with Ms. Andrews.
And to me, that's one of the great iconic photographs of not just second line culture, but of New Orleans. You know, so many people know that powerful image of that that ravaging kind of combination of emotion.
Yes, it's a very deep-rooted thing that does go, in fact, go back to Congo Square, because what you have are people who were enslaved, and a lot of people of my generation and people who have been educated about where we came from and why we're here, we don't like the term slaves. We prefer the term enslaved because mm-hmm. it wasn't a willing thing. We were forced into it. So we were enslaved, E-N-S-L-A-V-E-D. So I think it's important to note that in some instances, an enslaved person, perhaps that was the only time they could feel free, other than sleeping, was to be around people who were familiar to you, family and friends, and engaging in a dance, which essentially second lining is like a form of tribal dance. And it dates and goes directly back to Africa. Just about all the movements that you see on the second line, the footwork, what people have later on termed as twerking, are direct African specific tribal movements.
Well, and I love that notion of the ring straightening itself out and opening it out, itself up and making a line. That was an image that stayed with me very powerfully.
Because, you know, people talk about ring shouts
in
other cultures and all of that. Well, that is still a part of that direct line back to Africa, that in New Orleans, people of African descent have been fortunate in that we have been able to maintain a sense of home memory, as we call it, or spirit memory, that was, for whatever reason, strength or inner fortitude was not taken away. It still lives. And so that's what you see in the second line, the pageantry of an African tribal gathering. And that's all it is. It's just been transformed and translated into present day.
Right. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about the idea of communitas, because that is the concept that kind of underlies all of this as well.
Yeah, it definitely does. In a situation where people were enslaved, they had so little freedom and so little opportunity for personal expression in many respects. And this is where Dr. Jackson really goes into depth about the term communitas and what it means. But in short order, it's an opportunity to commune and to share spirit moments with people who know you and care about you and love you. And so what you see in the second line clubs are people who know each other. A lot of the clubs are born out of a particular neighborhood or people who went to a particular high school, because, you know, that's very important in New Orleans. Where did you go to high school?
Absolutely.
So those people already have a sense of community. But then in the club sense, they are operating through communitas, where they are expressing and carefully sharing the joy of being around one another. And it's a beautiful day, and we're dressed beautifully, and the music is playing, and the people are involved, and they're dancing, and they're just all into the music. And that little sweet spot, that moment that you see the second line, that is true communitas.
Well, and talk a little bit about what these organizations do for the community, because you do have a wonderful explanation about the difference between social aid and pleasure clubs and benevolent societies.
Yes, there is a very distinct difference. again, it goes back to a time with Côte Noire and Jim Crow where, A, people of color were not allowed to be buried through what we know as the traditional funeral homes or mainstream funeral homes. And there were very few funeral homes that would bury people of color, and they were owned by African Americans. So what happened is that if a particular family did not have the means to bury a loved one during the course of their life, they may pay a little bit a month or something on an insurance policy and belong to a benevolent society. And a lot of them were attached to churches. And what would happen when that person would die, the benevolent society would take that pooled money and contribute to the funeral expenses for that individual and perhaps give a little something to the family. So benevolent societies more or less came first. The oldest one is Young Men Olympian. That's been around since the 1800s, I believe 1880. Mm-hmm. And then out of that grew the Social Aid and Pleasure Club. And it just was a natural transformation because in order to raise funds for that benevolent purpose, they would have fish fries, they would hold dances and penny parties and things like that to add to those funds that were needed to care for the sick, the poor, and those that had passed away.
And so, you even interview grown men who have been members of these societies since they were like four.
Oh, my goodness. you know, it was a tremendous loss when Mr. Bucket, also known as Alfred Carter, passed away. He had been a member since he had been 7 or 8 years old. And here he was in his elder years, still out second lining. And he was just committed to it. You see it in his words, albeit hesitant. He's clear that this is something that was always a part of his life, and he wanted to make sure, no matter how he felt, he was going to dress out and get out there and be a part of the second line. He was just an incredible individual, a laborer. You know, he worked for K&B Warehouse for just about all his life, and that's what he did. And a lot of people in the second line or SAPC culture were basically they're working class people. They could be day laborers. They might be a cook. They could be a teacher. You know, they're not wealthy people, but it's the level of commitment that is what commands respect and admiration, I think.
I'm glad you mentioned Alvin Bucket Carter, because that to me was one of the most dazzling interviews that Valentine Pierce did. And there's that wonderful description when she asked him how he feels when he's out there. And he says, feel joy, feel happy, everybody looking good. It's a wonderful feeling. Everybody mm-hmm. having their fun, joyful thing to be out there. He just comes to life on the page.
He does. He really does. And he sort of was a quiet man. But if you see the other, there's another photograph with him leading a funeral second line. And he sort of has what people might call a flat expression. But my understanding is that that is just him. He says he's just probably the happiest person on earth, even though he's leading a funeral second line, because it's paying respect to that person and giving honor to the person and honoring the culture. And he was very strict about dress. You know, he believed in being dressed in the proper black and white and all of that sort of thing. He liked the colors, but he believed in the black and white because that was tradition. So he's missed. And when he did pass, there were representatives from nearly every Social Aid and Pleasure Club organization out there to second line for him as an elder and as an elder statesman in that culture.
Well, in these photographs, he is all elegance. I mean, you just look at him. I know. And to talk about that a bit, one of the things I especially enjoyed reading about was the pure fashion of this and the creative aspect of it. And like everything else in New Orleans, there's a deeper level to it. And as one of the essays says, work clothes tend to erase the black body. Sunday clothes celebrate it. And second line outfits are all about the intensity of color.
And that goes back to Africa, too, because if anyone has ever seen film or a video of a tribal gathering, there are feathers, there's beadwork, there's color. And that color tended to be associated with your tribe, and usually different tribes did not copy another. There were things that were indigenous to that particular tribe. And so it's a little bit different in New Orleans, but similar at the same time. For instance, the Black Men of Labor, they are determined to come out with some suit or pattern that has African cloth in it, kente cloth or cloth that was woven in Africa. So that's their thing. And the other clubs know that and tend not to do that as a rule. They're pretty much, that's their MO, for lack of a better term, and that's what they do. Then others may use more accessories or have alligator shoes or what, you know, everybody has sort of their own signature on the second line that they do. It'll show up in different colors and in different ways, but there's a bit of a pattern that they're following, and the other clubs know it.
And those photographs of the Black Men of Labor are some of the most exquisite in the book. They are really, really gorgeous. Now, you know, and I know that one of the prerogatives of putting a book like this together is that you get to save some things for yourself that you particularly want to do. And I love your interviews with Uncle Lionel Batiste.
Oh, my goodness.
Which must, you know, I know that was a while back, but still.
Oh, my. I cherish that. I wish it had been longer and we could have asked more questions. But he said what he needed to say, and then that was the end. And I think that was his personality. It was so funny that in the midst of interviewing him, people were passing by and yelling at him, "Hey, Uncle Lionel, how you doing? Hey, baby, how you doing?" You know, it was that interchange because he was such a recognizable part of that community. And I'm looking at Eric and I said, I hope we can get through this interview in the time that he's given us, because he had someplace to be. To get the questions in that we needed to do. So we got just enough. I wish it could have been more, but we got just enough because he was a busy man and, you know, very few people knew he was a tailor. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just such a sharp dressed man. I mean, he's amazingly dressed.
Well, and so beloved. So beloved, yes. In the community.
Yes, he was.
And also another interview that was very special and so much fun to read was your interview with Wanda Ruzon.
Oh, yes.
And
oh,
y'all had a little parade run-in, didn't you?
Yes, we did. I mean, I will always admire and love. I look up to Wanda. She is the epitome of a New Orleans Creole woman, mm-hmm. I think, in my estimation. Full of life and fiery and spitfire, yet elegant and refined at the same time. But I believe it was one of the Humphrey Brothers funeral second lines. I can't remember which one, but I got caught up like many people do at a second line. Music is going, it's a beautiful day, and, you know, everybody's just kind of second lining and doing whatever they do. And before I know it, she was the grand marshal, and I had gotten in front of her, which is a big no-no. And she just, I'm still second line dancing and everything. And next thing I know, I feel this little tap on my back. And I'm like, okay. And I'm still second line. And then the next tap was a little harder. Like, what is this? And I turn around and it's her. And I realize, oh my God, I'm in front of the second line. Oh my God, let me get out of the way. And it wasn't, she didn't holler or fuss or anything. She was just letting me know, hey, you're out of place.
But she obviously remembered. I mean,
right. Remember where you're supposed to be.
Right. Now, one of the things that fascinates me as I'm looking in this year of the tricentennial is that so many of these books about New Orleans history, the second line is becoming the prevailing metaphor for our city. And not just in history, but in fiction as well. And all these works seem to be paying tribute to the second line as the great metaphor of New Orleans. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think it's because it was born in the Crescent City. It came from Africa, but its birth was there. And just like jazz and some of the other cultural institutions that say this is New Orleans, the second line is that. And in a very strong and colorful outward manner. I don't think there's any place else that has made that a ritual where on any given Sunday, there might be a football game, but there's a second line. And so many, and the Saints are critical, you know, but a second line is equally critical in New Orleans. And I have talked to so many SAPC members who were displaced after Katrina, and they said they didn't care if there were snakes and mosquitoes and, you know, not enough food in the grocery store. They were coming back home. And they said it just didn't matter because there's no way that they could recreate that feeling in another city, even though a number of New Orleanians were there in that same city with them. So they were going to make whatever sacrifice was necessary to come back home. And I think that speaks to New Orleans as a very distinct culture, probably the most Caribbean, the most African in the nation. The people have retained a strong sense of who they are, and that never went away, and it was continued. I think what people are feeling is the spirit, but I think they also get they respect that people had enough backbone to say, you might have enslaved me, but I'm going to maintain who I am in the midst of that. And I think that's what people are always responding to and what they see. So if you, you know, when people promote New Orleans and they have the second line in it, that's okay. But I think the SAPC people are very clear. They don't want their culture diluted either.
Right. Well, we can always lift each other up in good times and bad, you know?
Yeah. So, very much so.
Well, thank you for making us all understand its true meaning. These beautiful photographs, these wonderful essays, yours and so many others by well-known scholars. It's just a treat. Everybody should read
this book.
We've been talking with Karen Celestan, whose new book is Freedom's Dance, Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs in New Orleans. You can meet her, along with photographer Eric Waters, Wednesday, February 7th at 5:30 at Community Book Center on Bayou Road. There will be a short second line with the Youth Brass Band. And Karen and Eric also appear Thursday, February 8th at 6 at the Foundation for Historical Louisiana meeting at the Old Governor's Mansion in Baton Rouge. Karen, thank you so much.
Susan, it was an absolute pleasure, and New Orleans should always stay New Orleans. It's more than a la ba, but it's la salle bon ton roulet.
I love music inspired by books, especially when it's a book I love. This song, Atticus, by the Noisettes, takes its inspiration from the beloved Harper Lee novel, To Kill a Mockingbird. It's from the Noisettes' 2009 album, Wild Young Hearts.
A mockingbird is to silence the song that seduces you. Why? 'Cause you'll need that desire in your heart to survive. And you'll need that burning fire in your soul to know you're still alive. So catch me when I fall. Or did I dive at your delight? In my heart I can fly, and I cannot disguise my love of time, and I wouldn't know how. Constellations tonight are so fearsomely bright. My love, I have no fear. I am at a cast now. Remember what I lost, like hot coals in my hand from days gone by. Like Pandora adored the euphorias her heart raised. Like love lost, you've got to try.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life. Tyler Bridges discusses Long Shot, his book about Louisiana's most recent gubernatorial election, Wednesday, February 7th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library. And coming up, George Saunders discusses his book, Lincoln in the Bardo, Tuesday, February 20th at 7 at the New Orleans Advocate. This is a ticketed event with a fee. Tickets available at Garden District Bookshop. Clayton Delery signs Out for Queer Blood, his book about the killing of Fernando Rios, Thursday, February 22nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Zachary Lazar discusses and signs Vengeance, along with a performance by The Graduates, a group of women who were once members of the drama club at St. Gabriel's Prison, February 22nd at 7 at Cafe Istanbul in New Orleans. Kendra Holly signs Keto Happy Hour, 50-plus low-carb craft cocktails to quench your thirst, Thursday, February 22nd at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Christopher Shipman and Brad Evans read from and sign their long collaborative poem, Keats is Not the Problem, Thursday, February 22nd at 7 at the Dogfish Reading Series, 2448 North Villery in New Orleans. The 2018 Writers and Readers Symposium will be held at Hemingbow in St. Francisville on February 17th. Participants will hear noted authors Catherine Savage Brosman, John Kemp, Michael H. Rubin, Gennaro Keeley Smith, and Emma Walsh. Registration is from 8:30 to 9 a.m. Saturday, February 17th at the Hemingbow Convention Center in St. Francisville, Louisiana. The coordinator for these events is Missy Kuick at Conundrum Books, 504-427-0421. Tickets for both events are available at 2018writersandreaders.brownpapertickets.com. Thomas Bonner and Judith Bonner discuss and sign the new edition of Sherwood Anderson and Other Famous Creoles, February 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. For more information about these events, check our website, wwno.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.